Hello and welcome everybody to ICMDA webinars. I'm Dr. Peter Saunders, the Chief Executive of the International Christian Medical and Dental Association. Today on ICMDA webinars, we have Professor John Gibson, who's speaking on the subject of preventing suicide, the story, the facts, and the future. So it's a very serious subject that we're dealing with today. So it's really a great pleasure for me to introduce an old friend, John Gibson. John and I have known each other for many years. And this webinar is going to offer a personal story of the devastating impact of suicide on family, friends, and colleagues, and asks how we might do better in preventing suicide at home, in education, at work, and in our communities. And following attendance at this webinar, delegates will be able to understand the devastating impact of suicide on family, friends, and colleagues and communities, understanding the factors influencing it, have the skills to construct and implement a suicide safety plan for themselves or someone else, and be challenged to implement changes in their own lives to ensure a positive approach to mental health and well-being. So it's a big brief we've given John. John Gibson is qualified in both medicine and dentistry, so fully equipped to speak to the whole of ICMDA. And he's worked in academic oral medicine for his entire career. He's currently emeritus professor of oral medicine in the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. He's chief executive also of the Canmore Trust charity, which he'll tell you more about, and a member of the Lived Experience panel for the Scottish Government's National Suicide Prevention Leadership Group. On the 20th of October 2019, John's youngest son, Cameron, took his own life at 24 years, and his world changed forever. John now works to prevent suicide and through the Canmore Trust to offer support to individuals, to families, to workplaces and communities affected by suicide. So John, so good to have you here today, and we really look forward to hearing what you have to share. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you everyone for joining this webinar. We stop just at the opening slide just for a moment, because although you will have read the intended learning outcomes, and indeed Peter has just shared them with us, I want us just to pause for a moment and understand that we are going to be talking about suicide today, and that normally generates a bit of a reverberation around the room, a little bit of anxiety. And as I will say shortly, the safety of everyone who's here is really important to me and to ICMDA, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. So learning outcomes, we've already heard read to us by Peter. We're going to cover a fair bit of ground today. But I think it's important at the outset that we stop for a moment. And I, in particular, have been deeply humbled as I've prepared for this webinar, because I normally speak to a relatively local national audience within the United Kingdom. But I realise that I'm speaking to an international audience today, and you come to this subject with different experiences, not just the trauma of suicide, perhaps, but the trauma of war, the trauma of brokenness for famine and for different reasons across the countries that you represent, that you love and you pray for on a daily basis. But some of you will also come from an environment, a country where suicide is illegal. And that's an important consideration and a humbling consideration as we kick off this webinar today. So I want you to know that you've humbled me in the preparation for this event today. As I said earlier, your well-being is really important to me, and some of you will come with personal experience of suicide. Some of you may even have made an attempt on your life. I'm so glad that you're here, and I'm so glad that you're alive. And so I just want to share with you at the outset that the Canmore Trust, the organisation that I founded and I represent today, has a 24/7 texting service available to you. You can text now. If you text Canmore to 85258, it's an international presence. You would be able to pick up with a trained mental health professional if you need to kick off any form of mental health discussion today. The question that I am always asked at the outset of such a meeting as this is, should we talk about suicide at all? And for some of you who are parents in particular, you may know there's an international debate going on about the reality of speaking about suicide in particular within schools, colleges and universities. And I want to reassure you today that you're doing absolutely the right thing by coming and speaking about suicide. There are now three major international studies which have done long-term follow-up, particularly dealing with young people, speaking not just about mental well-being or mental health, but talking specifically about suicide and the lived and living experience of that alongside suicide safety planning, which is something that we will come to later on today as we go through this. So you're here, you're very welcome to be here, and let me absolutely reassure you that talking about suicide saves lives. It never precipitates a suicidal journey. So you're here and doing the right thing today. So I wonder, as we start this, what are your thoughts on suicide? I wonder where my thoughts were on suicide 4 years ago, prior to Cameron's death. I had lost two patients to suicide, both as a result of chronic disease, one due to chronic pain, the other due to Behçet's syndrome, someone who felt they just could not face anything anymore in life. So I had some clinical experience of losing patients to suicide. And we did have a family history of suicide. I'd lost a cousin some years earlier. So I didn't come to this fresh, but let me tell you, I've been challenged in every cell of my being about what I now think about suicide, clinically, theologically, pastorally, personally, and experientially, as I will share with you shortly. And I hope that you are challenged in each of these domains as well as we go through today's seminar. And I wanted to kick off, because this is an ICMDA event, I wanted to talk about what the Bible might say about suicide, because there are seven very clearly iterated events of suicide in the scriptures. And of course, we all jump to the only New Testament reference to suicide, which is Judas. And because of that, he is the anti-hero, is he not? And we focus on the anti-hero. But I would encourage you to read about the other men who have taken their lives. And in particular, I want you to think about the hero Samson in Judges 16, who not only killed the Philistine army, but he also killed himself. He voluntarily took his own life. He committed an act of self-harm. He took his own life. And so I wonder, as you review these scriptures, that you might, as I have been, be deeply challenged about what suicide is and what it isn't within the context of scripture. So let's for a moment understand the devastation about suicide and its effects on family, friends, colleagues, and our communities. If we deal with doctors, first of all, and most of my data is in a westernized UK context, but doctors are struggling at the moment in the UK. We have a large number of clinical staff contacting the Canmore Trust in distress. And here we are from Doctors in Distress, a fantastic charity looking after the welfare of clinical staff in all domains, including dentists, telling us that 80% of UK GPs have reported being stressed, anxious, or depressed, not just on an intermittent basis, but on a regular basis. One in four GPs had heard of a colleague taking his or her own life. And just under 50% of UK GP practices have lost colleagues from their workforce due to stress or burnout. And then we come to dentistry, and we see this survey published in May 2022 across a large number of dental workforce questioned. And this, of course, is at the tail end of COVID. And we understand that COVID has had a significant impact and continues to have a significant impact healthcare staff. The staggering figure that one in seven of our UK dental workforce had considered taking their life during this survey period. One in seven. And if you like me, you're more visual in your understanding of things, that's 6,000 people. Imagine for a moment that 6,000 of our NHS workforce walked out on us and never came back again. That is the challenge of suicidality. 23% had sought help for their mental health issues, and the 50% in brackets is a very important 50%, because even of those who have sought help, only 50% felt that it was of any value to them whatsoever. Two-thirds considered that their mental health had worsened during the survey period, and nearly two-thirds felt that relationships, either at home or in the workplace, had suffered as a result of the COVID pandemic. And then we come to a really interesting study from Australia, so flipping from the UK right down across the equator to the land of Australia. And we find a really interesting paper there about factors associated with suicidal ideation and suicidal attempts in Australian dental practitioners. And we find there that one of the greatest risk factors for suicidal planning is severe psychological distress, but also a previous attempt on suicide. And so maybe this is learning point number one today, that in our history taking from patients and in our discussion pastorally and with friends and colleagues, asking the question about previous suicidality is a really important determining feature. So let's not shy away from asking, have you previously thought about or planned to take your life? Because as we'll see shortly, that is the major determining factor in suicide behavior. And then we jump across to the United States of America, where they graciously offer us a league table of professions with the highest suicide rates. And these are replicated largely across the world, where doctors, dentists, and veterinary surgeons, along with nursing staff, are overrepresented at the high end of this frightening league table. Doctors, dentists, veterinary surgeons, and nurses overrepresent. And we ask ourselves why that might be. And we'll come to that just shortly. What is suicide, ladies and gentlemen? Well, here is someone's report on what suicide is. It says, my experience of suicide is that it's like a bomb going off in your living room when you're sitting watching television. Afterwards, you're astonished that you're alive, but everything has changed forever. And you have a million shards of glass embedded in your soul. Some of them are so big that they fall out straight away, leaving gaping wounds. But the smaller pieces, well, they can take decades to work their way to the surface. And then, as Anne Grace Shinan has put it in this beautiful piece, suicide doesn't end the pain. It lays it on the broken shoulders of the survivors. And maybe this is take-home message number two, and it will be a challenging take-home message for all of us. And that is that suicide is not about wanting to die. Suicide is about wanting to end pain. Let that rest in the room just for a second. Suicide is not about wanting to die. Suicide is about wanting to end pain. And so the literature makes it quite clear that if I had 100 suicidal men and women in this room today, and I said to them, you have two choices. I can allow you to take your life, or I can give you a tablet which would take away the emotional pain that you're experiencing at the moment. 99 of those 100 individuals would say, I'll take the tablet, please, because I just want the pain to end. Suicide is not about death. And here's take-home message number three, dear friends, because I'm going to ask you to change your language when you speak about suicide, because traditionally we've talked about committing suicide. Committing refers to an illegal act. As I said earlier, some of you are watching from countries where suicide is still tragically an illegal act. So we're not going to use the word commit suicide anymore because it's an offence to the suicide community. Instead, we're going to talk about dying by suicide or taking his or her own life. Dying by suicide or taking his or her online. And just for a few moments on Cameron, as Peter told you earlier, our son Cameron at 24, a young veterinary surgeon, died by suicide on the 20th of October 2019, just 4.5 years ago. Cameron was a happy-go-lucky man, a lovely man, a deeply committed sportsman, a runner, kayaker, a mountaineer, with a deep love for the large animal practice that he was part of as a veterinary surgeon, the job he'd always wanted to be. There was no history of psychological distress, and he left no note. He had a huge circle of wonderful friends and colleagues, and Cameron's death is, for us, a total mystery. It has completely blindsided us. It has completely taken us out as a family. And struggling with all of the understanding of that has been a deep challenge over this last while. I wonder on the journey if I thought that our grief might somehow fit this Kubler-Ross grief curve that everyone talks about. And of course, this was never designed for this kind of grieving. But I thought it might at least follow a logical pattern of denial and anger and bargaining, depression, and then acceptance, five logical steps and stages. How wrong I was, because suicide grief is unlike anything that I have ever encountered, and I've encountered a lot of grief in life. This is something quite different. And can I just emphasize to you as clinicians, and maybe as family members, if you have encountered suicide, that anger is a major part of the grief journey. That anger has to sit somewhere. And unfortunately for you as clinicians, it may sit with you. And I'm going to encourage you here, take home message number four, not to fight that anger, not to write angry letters back defending yourself, but just to accept that that anger is going to be placed somewhere and now it's you, and just let it blow away in the wind as it will do eventually. And you will have helped a grieving family move on their journey. Let that anger sit a while with you or with whomsoever. A really important part of the grieving journey. Well, what about me? Here was I, 8 months after Cameron died, thinking that as a family we were making some progress in our grief journey. And then I had a catastrophic moment when I too made an attempt on my life 8 months after Cameron died. And I look back on that now and I feel like I'm looking at a different person. But it felt logical and it felt the right thing to do. I felt almost as if I was being driven to release my family from yet further horrors that I was experiencing. And that's been a tough journey of psychiatric care for 4 months. And then back to a place of relative stability. And what then happened for me was that I realized that there was a sixth stage to grieving. And David Kessler, in his amazing book, if you want to read more about grieving and suicide, read his book, Finding Meaning. David Kessler challenges us throughout his book to find meaning, and I could not find and cannot find meaning in Cameron's death. But in the final two pages, he asks to substitute the word purpose instead of meaning. And that saved the day for me, because suddenly I found purpose in walking and founding the charity, the Canmore Trust, and then walking from Land's End to John O'Groats in the UK, some 1,203 miles. And so finding that meaning was difficult. Finding purpose was a remarkable thing as we drew more and more families from the suicide community together as they too found purpose. Yet every day I'm challenged by the reality of Cameron's death and wonder about what warning signs we missed. Few doctors in the family, what did we miss? And so we need to consider then, what are the factors influencing suicidal behaviour? But first of all, the shocking statistic, because I couldn't give you all the statistics for all the countries that you represent. But I can tell you that there is one suicide every 40 seconds. That's not a mistake on the screen. One suicide every 40 seconds across the world. And the sociologists tell us that 135 individuals are affected by each of those suicides, directly and catastrophically impacted. And in the UK alone, although we don't have formal or official data on this, there are some half a million attempted suicides every year in the UK. A phenomenal figure. So let me then talk about prevention for a second. And I'm going to ask you to think a little bit about shifting your language again. So maybe this is take-home message number five. And that is that suicidal ideation is very common. A recent paper from Rory O'Connor in Glasgow suggests that one in five, 20% of men and women under the age of 35 will have a significant moment or period of suicidal ideation. And so that is actually pretty commonplace, but quite different from suicidal planning. And so I think we've spent a lot of time getting anxious about suicidal ideation, when in fact, a tiny percentage of those with suicidal ideation move forward to suicidal planning. And it's that group that we need to pick up and learn much more about if we're going to prevent more suicides. And so for the next couple of slides, we're going to talk about the contributory factors to suicidal thinking, and then challenge that with the contributory factors to suicidal behavior, because each is quite different. So dealing with suicidal thinking, first of all, you won't be surprised to know that for most people who are entertaining suicidal thoughts, that there is a bit of a biochemical storm within the brain, a bit of a serotonin challenge. But often that comes in the midst of challenge to perfectionism. And again, I wonder if that's why the clinical professions are overrepresented, since most of you listening in today will experience perfectionism in your life. And then the third bullet point, if that is then challenged with breaking of your moral code, particularly if you work in an environment where you're not allowed to work at the high level of clinical standards that you demand of yourself, then that too becomes a contributory factor. And then early life adversity, like poverty, I'll come on to that shortly. Interestingly, there is some evidence in the literature that the hypothalamic pituitary axis is challenged in a subset of those with suicide, so that they don't have a normal response to stress. And then attachment issues normally related to childhood. And so then on to contributory factors in suicidal behavior, and access to means being a major contributory factor. And that may be another explanation why the clinical professions are right there at the top of the professions most likely to take their life, but maybe not, because in veterinary practice, for example, access to means, the drug, is only the way by which 50% of those who die by suicide take their life. And so access to means is important, but it's not everything. Plans made, previous exposure to suicidal behaviour in family, friends or colleagues, impulsivity, heightened pain endurance, and then interesting concepts for those of us who come from a faith community, fearlessness about death or mental imagery about death or dying. And then importantly, as I touched on previously, past suicidal behaviour. And then also importantly, and increasingly obvious to those of us who work in the suicide community, untreated mental ill health, especially bipolar disorder. And the attempts on suicide for those who have bipolar disorder, normally undiagnosed or treated, are somewhere around two-thirds. And so making that diagnosis and pursuing treatment for that diagnosis is clearly a vital part of medical practice. And as my hero of the faith, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, said, there comes a point where we need to stop pulling people out of the river, and we need to go upstream and find out why they're falling in. And if you, as a person of faith, really want to get your hands dirty, then this is where you need to operate. It's not in the clinical domain. It's changing society. It's changing a world that is making more and more young people spontaneously suicidal and saying, I don't want to be in this world anymore. It is too broken. There's too much fighting. There's too much hatred. This is where you would want to get your sleeves rolled up and do some genuine societal prevention of suicide. And of course, what all of these studies that I've quoted so far don't mention anything about is the spiritual battle, because our battle is not against flesh and blood. And this wonderful scripture from Peter, which has astonished me since the moment of my conversion, tells me that I have an enemy that prowls around me like a roaring lion, looking not just to roll me over and duff me up a bit, but he wants to destroy me. He wants to devour me, and he wants to destroy my witness and my. And so there's a challenge for those of you who are in leadership within churches and parts of the world where we need to pray again and understand the force of prayer in protecting not just our young ones, but our entire nation. And so as we think about prevention, I'm going to ask you to think about how you might open a conversation with someone that you're worried about. And first of all, it's important that you find that conversation happening in a safe space, not a public space, not a staff room, not a classroom. And then I'm going to encourage you to listen with empathy and not to try and fix things. It's a great criticism I hear all the time in the suicide community that doctors in particular, in their busyness and chasing patients, try to fix things. Just do this, this, and this. Take these tablets, see the counsellor, you'll be fine. He just told me how to fix it, and I just wanted him to listen to me. And then importantly, with boldness, ask the question, are you thinking of killing yourself? Take home message number 5. Please learn to ask this question with boldness. Don't lessen it, and don't bring judgment into the room by saying, you're not planning to do something silly, are you? Just ask the question, are you thinking about killing yourself? And then importantly, how long can you stay safe for? Because I can't speak to you just now, I've got 15 patients waiting, but if you could wait 2 hours, I would see you at the end of my clinic. Could you stay safe for 2 hours? Yes, doctor, I could stay safe. Then I'll trust you with that. Sit in the waiting room and I'll see you at the end of the clinic. And then this remarkable thing called signposting, which we're very good at, but achieve very little, because signposting does not achieve anything. Going with an individual to the place of safety is the important part of our professional ability. Signposting can be very dangerous. And then another criticism that I sometimes hear of the church community was my pastor just said, could he pray for me? Which I'm sure was so well intended and so beautiful, but actually I needed to go to a place of safety. I needed to have lunch or dinner with a family, or I needed a hug. And so prayer for the faith community may be very important, but I'm going to challenge you that it may not be enough. So thirdly, we're going to have the skills to construct this suicide safety plan. And the reason for this is that in over 3/4 of cases of suicide, in Scotland at least, there have been multiple opportunities to intervene and offer safety or offer the development of a safety plan. And so we need to learn it, and we need to learn the skills as children or adolescents. And so I'm going to direct you to this remarkable resource, an app called Stay Alive, developed by the Grassroots Charity in the UK, but with an international reach. And in that app, it allows you to build the skills to develop so-called suicide safety planning with 6 major domains. So what are the signs that I'm heading into a crisis? What are my current coping strategies and how could I augment them? What are the people and social settings that might provide distractions for me? And who can I genuinely ask for help? And if things are really escalating, what are the local, regional or national emergency numbers that I should? And then very importantly, in the immediacy of this moment, how can I make my environment safe? And you won't be surprised to know that much of that is about getting into a place of social interaction with another human being. So use the app or use these 6 bullet points and let's learn together the skill building suicide safety planning. But what's also very important is that more action is needed to make our societies and our world a kinder place. The literature is very clear that kindness and compassion saves lives. So important to ask us, and I recommend to you this Scottish Government initiative called the Time Space Compassion Initiative. You'll find it online. And it asks the question, do I have the time to deal with the issues in front of me today? Is this the right space and the safe space to deal with what's in front of me? And importantly, do I, as a busy healthcare professional, at the end of the day, have the emotional energy to take this consultation forward and lead this individual to a safe space? Or should someone else take that? And then finally, ladies and gentlemen, in the last 2 or 3 minutes, I'm going to challenge all of us about our own lives and how we might take a more positive approach to our own mental health and well-being. There are many ways of defining well-being, but I love this definition by Shah and Marx, almost 20 years old now, saying it's more than happiness. It's about feeling satisfied and happy in the context of making a contribution to the community. There's a pivotal point for us to take on board. And then we go to Ed Diener, the American psychologist who wrote the 11 pillars of well-being. And I've loved this piece of work. And I teach a lot now on this piece of work. And the first and the final pillars are really important here because as healthcare professionals, this is the mistake we make, that we build our sense of purpose and meaning into our enjoyable and fulfilling career. But Diener says that you're not allowed to do that. That's the mistake that doctors and dentists and other healthcare professionals make, because we need to find our sense of purpose and meaning outside our professional world. Because otherwise, all we do is we just keep working to perpetuate that sense of purpose and meaning within our workplace. And so we never go home, we never rest, and our families get a second best deal from us. And so Diener's work is challenging and motivational. By all means, enjoy your fulfilling and enjoyable career, but also coach the football team on a Saturday morning. Also run the scout troop on a Friday evening. And just in completion of all that we've said, I'm back to the scripture again, because the scriptures have taught me a lot on my grief journey. And believe me, I've struggled a bit in my faith. But God has been good, and God has been by my side throughout. And particularly in Job, and please don't think that I'm comparing myself to Job, but I've learned from Job, because Job found the importance of a safe space, and he definitely found the importance of good friends and bad. He also found the importance of hope and purpose. And when you read those first pivotal verses of Job chapter 1, when he lost 7 sons and 3 daughters, he then moved on in his remarkable encounter with God. And the scriptures tell us that the Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the former. But we're left with an understanding that the former part of Job's life was still blessed. He suffered. And in his suffering, he drew close to God. Job's suffering allowed him to draw close to God. And isn't, of course, that the way of the cross? And then this, the remarkable words from Job in those early days, almost immediately after he'd heard the servant come and tell him that his 7 sons and 3 daughters had been killed, he said, "My goodness, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be his name. May the name of the Lord be praised." Brothers and sisters, we have much to learn about blessing, what it is and what it is not. We see when we arrive at the top of a Chamonix mountain ready to ski for a week, "The Lord has blessed me with a fresh fall of snow." I wonder if we could say the Lord has blessed me with suffering and with brokenness, because in that he has brought me closer to him. What is more, I consider everything is lost because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ. And for his sake, I've lost all things. I consider them garbage that I might gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but from faith in Christ. I want to know Christ. Yes, to know his remarkable suffering, his resurrection, becoming like him in death, and somehow attaining to the resurrection. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you for coming with me on this short journey today. Please feel free to look at the resources available through Canmore. You can text Canmore to 85258 anytime, day or night. Encourage your patients, your friends, your staff to do so. And follow us, would you, on social media, Instagram, Messenger, or you can get us anytime at the.canmore.trust@bt.internet. I think, Peter, it's time for questions, but sometimes there are no answers.
Thank you so much, John. That was quite incredible. And we have got a time now for four questions. So, John, I wonder if I can ask, just to pick up, first of all, you talked about the difference between finding meaning, the title of the book, and finding purpose, and how it was when you latched on the idea of finding purpose that you were able to move forward much more effectively. Can you just unpack that a little for us, explaining the difference between finding meaning and finding purpose?
Thank you, Peter. It's a great question. I think you would probably need to read David Kessler's book to make that understanding. But for me, finding meaning was too passive process. It felt as if I was lighting a candle and sitting down and waiting for God to speak to me whilst I was living now in a new world where there were literally dozens of young men and women around me dying by suicide. And so the challenge for me was not about passivity and acceptance. It was about motivation to change and to take action. And so for me, that journey of purpose, and I'm not sure it would be the same for everyone, but I moved from this place of grieving passivity to a place of being angry. And my anger landed in the world of suicide. My anger landed with a fresh realization that I'd never realized before. Suicide is the biggest cause in the UK of men dying under the age of 50. And nobody's talking about it. That's not true. We're beginning to talk about it. But we talk about testicular cancer and prostate cancer, and we talk about all of these things. And, you know, kids could write an essay at school on testicular cancer or prostate cancer, but I'm not sure they could write an essay on suicide. And I think we owe it to them to let them know that the greatest killer of young men and women, young men in particular, in a westernized context, is suicide. And we have to support them and help them to understand that. So that was my journey of finding purpose, a drivenness to action, really, through anger.
And the Canmore Trust has now been going for several years, and you set this up because you've moved out of clinical medicine as well, haven't you, to devote your life completely to this. Can you tell us a bit about how you set up the Canmore Trust, who was helpful, the direction it's taken?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So Canmore is an anagram of Cameron. I don't know whether everyone would have realised that. So, but also there's this sense that we can do more and indeed must do more. And so Canmore really came out of me starting to walk again and finding beauty in nature, frog spawn, golden eagles, red kites, budding trees, just started to swell my heart again. And I found myself starting to be in contact with myself in the moment and in God again in the moment. And then I realized that men needed to walk and talk. While I was walking, I came across in a pivotal moment, a young French man away in the hills of Scotland. And he'd lost his father during COVID, and his younger brother had taken his life as a result of losing their father. And he and I walked together for, maybe 3 hours that day. And we cried together and we hugged together and we spoke together. And from that, I realized that we were needing to meet to talk. And we were also needing to meet to support each other in this concept of suicide postvention. And I guess in that moment, the Canmore Trust was born. And so we now put ourselves out there as a charity that wants to work with individuals, families impacted by suicide, but increasingly in work places, schools, colleges, and universities where there has been a suicide as well. And so sometimes that's walking, sometimes it's talking, sometimes it's silent walking, because often you can walk for many miles before a man starts to open up. But I've also discovered that men don't do well across the room from you. They do much better walking side by side, shoulder to shoulder. That's when men really want to walk and talk together. And so all of these ideas coalesced into the Canmore Trust, which we now spend a lot of our time. I'm busier now than I was ever as the Dean of a Dental School. And that's both good and bad, of course. It's good that we're helping, but we need to see numbers of suicides tumbling. And we really do need to make that effort to see that happen.
And with the Canmore Trust, you're obviously providing support for families that have been involved. You're doing advocacy work as well and prevention work. What sort of activities?
Yep. So we are fairly good at holding our government to account and discussing situations with our politicians, both local and national. We have a national debate at the moment in the United Kingdom about our National Health Service. And there are parts of our National Health Service which are glorious and functioning wonderfully. And there are bits of it, particularly within mental health, that are really struggling. And so we're lobbying and we're working hard to try and encourage our politicians to build a much more robust system. But also, and it's interesting that I share this today, because I spoke about Archbishop Desmond Tutu's comments about going further upstream. And the Scottish Government last year published its 10-year action plan for suicide prevention. And for the first time of anywhere in the world that I'm aware of, it mentions going upstream. It mentions dealing with loneliness, poverty, the brokenness of societies. And therefore, it's a pretty hard-hitting 10-year plan, which will require action across all domains, action across all parts of the country, local and national. And so it's a call to arms, really. It's a call to making the country a kinder, more resilient place to allow us to start saving lives.
John, in terms on the advocacy side, in terms of measures that governments can put into play, what does the evidence tell us about what is most effective in reducing suicide rates, particularly among young people?
That's a really good question. And you arrive at a very pivotal time in answering that question, because so as an academic, I have spent all of my professional life as a biological researcher. And as I've come to the suicide literature, I've been deeply challenged that there's actually very little about any biological basis for suicide. And so I have encouraged government and funding bodies to look at this a bit differently and to ask a much bigger question. Instead of assuming that suicide is a psychological diathesis, what if it's a membrane transport protein within the limbic system? What if it's that it's the issue? What if the reason that our clinically facing staff have the highest levels of suicide is that they're encountering a pathogen in their clinical practice? What if that's the reason? And I'm not saying that it is by any shape or form, but we need to ask a bigger question. And so one of our advocacy roles is to ensure that research broadens within the debate around suicide to find out what it actually is. And the reason that I challenge the whole issue about psychological research is not because I think it's wrong, but because we've had 50 years of psychological research in suicide, and actually we've made very little difference to the numbers of suicides in most parts of the world. And that's not a criticism of psychologists. It's a challenge to all of us to pick up a different aspect of this and see if we can answer the question in a different way.
John, we've got a number of questions, as you would expect from doctors here. I think three different people have asked about the issue of assisted suicide, I know there's pressure to change the law in Scotland to make it legal. We've got one doctor here from Canada who's also saying, I'm worried that in our country, that making so-called medical assistance and dying available increases the risk of suicide. What are your what's your take on that in terms of what the evidence shows? I guess this relates to the whole question, I guess, of making suicide respectable in a sense.
Well, it's a really interesting question because it's something, as you've just alluded to, that we're wrestling with in Scotland, and it's going to cause us some real difficulty. Never before has life been more precious to me than in these years since Cameron died. I now see, and through my own suicide experience as well, I now see life as an utter gift, and it's a gift that must be preserved at all costs. But here's a word of caution to the Christian community, because we need to be very careful and become less emotive and more evidence-based in our approach to this. Because I get really disappointed when I hear Christians in particular and peoples of other faith talk about this only from the heart and not from the head. And so we need to have evidence. And I was really disappointed recently to see some actually misinformation, and it stemmed from the Christian community coming out of Canada. And we need to be really careful that we get our information right and that we debate correctly, because that's the way that the debate might be won. And so, as the questioner has asked, I too am concerned that we cross a divide here. But I think the greatest challenge in all of this is that I'm not sure that we've actually got our palliative care as well organized and as properly funded as we might do. And I also think that people are making decisions because their granny or their grandpa or their husband or their wife had a poor death. Well, that's not a reason to introduce voluntary euthanasia. That's absolutely not a reason. That's a reason to increase our ability to give a good death to people and to support them in palliative care. And so I think we're in a really difficult time. But the thing that I would encourage everyone to think about is the beauty of life, the sanctity of life, and the utter gift that is life. And once you take that away, there is no going back. And therefore, we need to be really careful about how we handle this. But let's handle it in a more evidence-based way than perhaps we've done today.
You gave some statistics early on and showed really quite dramatically that those in the caring professions, doctors, dentists, nurses, are among the highest and most susceptible. And you hinted that that probably had something to do with the fact of having access to means to take their lives. Are you aware of any statistics, data on pastoral staff, people involved in Christian ministry, either missionaries or in church leadership?
I'm not, and I'm also a little bit concerned about how that data might be interpreted, because we still live in an era where clergy in particular have a tendency not to acknowledge the reality of a suicide and encourage families away from accepting suicidal, the reality of suicide, to still calling it a tragic accident. And nothing could be more obfuscating, and nothing could be more averting the healing journey than to do that, because the grief journey, if your son or daughter, mother or father, husband, wife dies in a tragic accident. So if Cameron had died gored by a bull or killed in a road traffic accident on his way to an emergency call, that would have been terrible. But that's part of the great circle of life. But when Cameron dies by his own hand, that changes the landscape completely. And so it's important that people are not misled into a false starting point for their grief. And so if you are pastorally involved, I would really encourage you to think long and hard about ensuring, tough as it is at the outset, that the individual in front of you for whom you are caring pastorally understands that this is a suicide. Not forcing that upon them, but just gently and lovingly coming to a place. We talk about balance of probabilities as we discuss with families, because sometimes families are left in a place where we don't know, there's no note, and it's not absolutely obvious what's happened. What does balance of probability allow you to determine here? What was the pre-morbid state of the individual? What was their emotional or mental health journey like leading up to this point? So these are important parts of the pastoral equation.
Mm. John, you described your own experience with Cameron, and that it really, from your description, came completely out of the blue and there was no note at all. How unusual is that experience? Experience?
Yeah. That's a great question. And it's difficult to get solid data on this, apart from it is evident that the number of so-called spontaneous suicides, and let me define that, I would define a spontaneous suicide as a suicide where there is no obvious pre-existing psychological disharmony or distress. It is without doubt those numbers are increasing, and those numbers are particularly increasing in younger people. Now, why is that happening? We don't actually know yet. There are a number of studies looking particularly at the influence of social media on young lives. And I don't think there can be any doubt that social media is both wonderful and horrific at the same time. And so I think those studies, and I'm prejudging, forgive me, having come to you with an evidence-based approach today, I'm now prejudging the literature. But I have no doubts from the experience that we have as a charity working in this arena now that social media plays a part in a number of suicides that we know about. And so I think that we will in due course understand that social media has an implicative role in young suicide in particular. What we're also aware of is that the whole internet access leads to a completely different world now. And one of the things, and I hope this doesn't cause anyone any offense, we need to talk openly about these things. One of the things that I've discovered is that pornography is utterly pervasive in the lives of men. And for Christian men in particular, for people of faith, that can bring very real challenges and disgrace internally. So we're back to our slide looking at contributory factors. If you're breaking your moral code on a regular basis, that leads to suicidal thinking. And so what I would say to anyone, get a buddy alongside you. You know, if you're struggling with pornography, get a buddy alongside you, and you'll be astonished as you walk with them and say, one of the reasons I'm walking with you is I just wanted to say I'm really struggling with pornography. And they'll say, well, join the club, because I am as well. But just join them and walk alongside them and graciously explore and unburden the individual that you're walking with. It's not a judgment. Let's bring the whole thing before God and open this up, because he's there to help us and walk with us. And so I just implore people who are struggling in that area to get a buddy alongside you, someone that you can trust, and just say, please help me. And when I'm tempted, I'm going to give you a phone and say I'm being tempted. Is that okay? Absolutely. Let's have mutual accountability together and see if we can beat this. Because it is a demon. And there is no doubt that I would go as far as to say the majority of men today are struggling with access to it.
Thank you. What's the best thing from your own experience, from those you've walked with, those you've cancelled and supported? Excuse me. What's the best thing we can say or do to someone who has lost a loved one to suicide? And perhaps that's there are different stages too, in the acute stage and then the ongoing stage.
Yeah, that's a lovely question, and I'd really appreciate the question as someone who's lost my son to suicide. So what I would say is one of the most difficult seasons is after the funeral, and everyone else has gone back to work and back to their life, that's the difficult moment. And so that's the moment that I would ask you to drop the card in, or send the text, or better still, send yourself in. Send the hands and the feet of the living Christ to that person, and just sit with them. The most important thing I do in all of this is put the kettle on and make a cup of tea. And please don't think I'm being unduly humble when I say that. It's absolutely true. It's going into someone's house and sitting a while with them, crying together, admitting together that I can't fix this because it's unfixable. And well, I just put the kettle on, we could have a cup of tea, and then we might go for a walk and see where that goes. That's what I do. And then, but to properly answer your question, not forgetting about anniversaries. So put a note in your diary when your friend's son died, and when the funeral was, and just be in contact and say, look, I'm just really thinking of you today. I don't know, I don't have any words to say, but I'm just really thinking of you today. And then really importantly, ask about Cameron. Ask about the dead person, because he's still alive in the minds and the hearts and the families of those who have lost catastrophically. And so I love it when people say to me, what are your thoughts of Cameron today? That's the pivotal question. What are your thoughts of Cameron today? Well, today's a good day, so I'm thinking about having skied with him. I'm thinking about catching his first fish with him. I'm thinking about some great thoughts. But you might catch me on a horrific day. If I'd been doing this last Friday, I would hardly have been able to speak to you because I was just taken unawares by a tsunami of grief. And I can't tell you what kicked it off, but it was dreadful. And then I wake up on Saturday and it's okay again. And I think, oh, put your big boy pants on and get on with this and move forward. So, yeah, all of those things, just accepting that it's so broken. Just give me a hug. Just say, Joanne, I've got no words. I'm so sorry. Will I put the kettle? That'd be great. That'd be great.
Thank you. So helpful. We're virtually out of time, but I did want to ask you just one more question. And you've woven a lot of Christian testimony, a lot of scripture into what you've been telling us, and you've made reference to a number of passages as well. But were there any particular scriptures that were really helpful for you on your journey and have been helpful for others in your experience?
Oh, I'm smiling because the scripture from Job 1:24, is it? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be his name, has been the most challenging, difficult, blessed scripture that I've ever had to wrestle with in my life. And I'm not joking. And I'm still blown away by the fact that Job loses his 10 kids, and within four verses, he says, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be his name. I'd lived for 55 years in what I thought was blessing, because I had financial security, had an amazing wife and family, no problems, wonderful kids, not a moment of trouble. And that for me, I thought, was God's blessing. And then the Lord took away. And one of my greatest struggles was accepting that the Lord has taken away. He's either sovereign of all or he's not sovereign at all. So whatever the means, God has taken Cameron away. And wrestling with that has been hugely difficult. And I'm now in a place where I can accept. But the next bit's the difficult bit. Blessed be his name. I'm learning to live in the worship of this living God who does things so differently from how I had lived my first 55 years of life. And learning to trust him in that newfound place is a deep challenge. And so that's the verse that is both a blessing and a challenge every single day of my life. And I love him, and it's difficult. And my goodness, it's a challenge.
John, thank you so much. And not just for really enlightening us about the issue and how important it is, but in sharing so freely from your own experience as well. And we really we're so grateful for what you're doing, and we wish you all the best as you press on in this ministry, and we're just so grateful for your time today.
There will be people who will have been challenged by today's talk, and Canmore is here for you if you would like to be in contact with us. either through texting or through our email address at the website. So please don't face any challenge that you're facing alone. That's really important.
So thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again soon on ICMDA webinars. May God bless you. Thank you.